Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
8, 7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition, 1. And may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. Stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and David Bowie. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
This is Don, your philosopher and political science guy.
This is Major Tom to ground control. This is Rob, cognitive psychologist.
This is Daniel, and I'm going to let you in on the latest celebrity gossip.
Oh my God.
So what's Brad doing now?
Who cares about Brad? It's all about Jenny McCarthy.
I thought you said celebrity news. Who's she? What's she famous for these days?
Being an idiot.
Hey, that's what a lot of them are famous for.
Well said.
Around the blogosphere, the skeptical blogosphere, there's been lots of talk that Jenny McCarthy is suddenly like backtracking on her anti-vaccination views. That her son doesn't actually have autism, all these grand things, and they all seem to come down to a article from Hollywood Life.
Wow, so you mean like she got hit on the head and saw reason or what?
There's nothing obvious as to why she's suddenly backing down, mostly because she isn't really backing down.
Are you saying that the Hollywood Life was not a good source of journalistic integrity?
Yeah, they say that they got this from Time magazine, and apparently in that article it suggests that Evan, her son, suffers from Landau-Kleffner syndrome rather than autism. Reading through the Time article, though, I didn't really see any mention of that. She never said it. There's no, like, there's no doctors of theirs that have said this. It seems to be just baseless speculation based on the fact that her son doesn't appear to have, really big symptoms anymore.
So what does the Time article say about this? Or what does she say in the Time article?
One interesting thing that she said is when asked... one second, I lost the part.
So basically, she's being interviewed.
Right.
And this reporter is basically saying, well, look, Jenny McCarthy, vaccination rates, you know, autism rates have risen, despite the fact that, you know, mercury's been taken out of vaccines. And in conjunction, you know, cell phone use has risen.
Obesity has risen. All these...
Diabetes.
Why is it that, you know, autism is being caused by vaccinations? Why isn't it being caused by, you know, cell phones, for instance?
But doesn't she say in that, well, you're right, you know... these vaccinations, they cause obesity, they cause increased asthma, they cause cell phone use. I mean,
that, does she actually say that?
She does not actually.
Well, it makes as much sense.
What she says in it is basically that, well, Time Magazine actually asked her some decent questions. I will give them props for that.
Yeah, definitely.
And basically what she answered is, ignoring the question about all these other things that have risen at the same time, she basically just brought up some anecdotal evidence that her son was handed to her, like, immediately with a Band-Aid because he got a shot, like, right away. And that's about the extent of how she explains that. But the thing that a lot of skeptics are bringing up, that she no longer hates vaccines, comes from the question that they asked her, and this is the reporter. In many cases, vaccines have effectively eliminated diseases. Measles is among the top five killers in the world of children under 5 years old. Yet it kills virtually no one in the U.S. thanks to vaccines. And what she replied is, people have the misconception that we want to eliminate vaccines. Please understand that we are not an anti-vaccine group. We are demanding safe vaccines. We want to reduce the schedule and reduce the toxins. And then she goes on to swear a bit and stupid things like that. But it's kind of within that.
Well, you left out the best part. If you ask a parent of an autistic child if they want the measles or the autism, we will stand in line for the beeping measles.
Yeah, exactly. She's a little ridiculous.
Well, isn't it kind of like saying, you know, listen, I'm not anti-vax, but if someone wants to be a bad mother and vaccinate their children, that's their right.
Somehow this sounds like, and oh no, I was going to bring in the H word, the someone whose name begins with H, and I don't want to ruin it, says that I'm not anti-Jewish. I just think that they should be safe and put somewhere else. That sounds sort of like what she's sounding like here.
Did you just Godwin this?
No, because I didn't bring the name in.
Uh-huh. Well, what I just thought was really amusing is that the Hollywood Life article actually links directly to this Time Magazine article. And they make so many claims about it that are nowhere to be found in the article they linked to.
I guess they just assume that the readers don't check up on them.
Well, no, actually, and that's the truth. I mean, this is a double layer of skepticism, right? I mean, first, Jenny McCarthy, in the article itself, shows sort of an absence of understanding your own position, because she says, well, I'm not against it, I just want safe. But by most of the definitions, what a safe vaccine would be an unattainable goal, right? And two, it's ignoring the fact that, you know, sure, she would much rather have her child dead from measles than have autism. I mean, that's kind of one of the things that she's sort of saying there. But the second layer is, you have, you know, one news site reporting on another news site's article, and how, you know, they assume people will just take it, you know, here we got a link, therefore you can trust this. And it's like, well, no, you should sometimes follow up on things.
It's a good lesson in checking your sources, and not just from the reporter's point of view, but from the reader's point of view. You know, don't take what you read as, you know, definite truth. You know, check your sources. I mean, that's one of the primary goals of skepticism, isn't
it? It's one of the primary goals of, you know, being able to tell the difference between fake things and real things.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why we post show notes, so you, our wonderful listeners, can check up on us and make sure that we aren't just spouting crap.
That's right.
You know, speaking of spouting crap, you know, sometimes it just makes me see red. There's an article that I was listening to.
Clever segue from Don McLennan.
Thank you. On Quirks and Quarks, about a study that shows that that's red, actually, people react faster to the color red. And I think that's really important, because we want to know why Canada did so well in the Olympics.
Woo!
Maybe it's because our team colors are red. A study done by Dr. Fall, F-A-L-L-A-H, at York University in Toronto, shows that people's reaction times to the color red are significantly faster than that to the color blue, for instance. And that there's a correlation of where it is on the spectrum to your reaction times. And before, they've done these studies and they said, well, you know, there are different pathways, different parts of the brain were responsible for different aspects of cognition, and color was sort of seen as not to be actually that important. Well, important, but it not a deciding factor as far as how things are processed.
Yeah, like it when it did make a difference, as we were talking about this before the show, I thought it might be a learned response, that because red is so often used as a warning color, stop lights, stop signs, you know, the on-air light in the studio, that we learn to respond and look at red because it's very salient.
Right, and the way this study was done is it actually measured eye movement, and based upon the color, which color your eye, little dots on the screen, where did your eye go to first? And it was consistently found that your eye went to red before blue, and that, again, like I say, this was correlated with the spectrum. So anywhere on the spectrum compared to anywhere else in the spectrum, you could judge how fast you would see that, relatively speaking, based on where it was and how far apart it was on the spectrum.
Well, interesting implications with that. I mean, if you look at it from like an evolutionary standpoint, I mean, isn't red also the color of blood?
Well, actually, in the interview that I was listening to, he'd mentioned that, you know, we see a lot of green. You know, the ground is green, plants are green, blue is sky, right? It's when we see other colors, for example, red of blood or of other such things, that there would be an evolutionary selective process to see things differently than that. Although, of course, I thought it was funny. In an interview, he said, and what kind of toads not to lick, because there are certain toads. But, of course, I think most of those toads are blue. But,
well, if you need a color to tell you not to lick a toad, I think you might be in a bit more trouble.
But that was a big craze.
That seems like it might the idea of evolutionary pressures selecting for, you know, speedy noticing of red would not quite mesh with the idea that it's correlated with where the color is in the spectrum. Because that might...
Well, yeah, because it sounds to me it'd be more sort of like noticing like an outsider color. If you constantly see green and blue all the times, a color like red or even like yellow or purple might jump out and go, whoa, what's that, right?
Yeah.
It could be that the mechanism for like looking for a different color within a sea of other colors might be more difficult to evolve than simply reacting differently to different ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, so maybe one of the ideas is that, you know, there's electrochemically, you know, there's different energy based upon where it is in the spectrum, and that may actually instill something. But the researcher himself basically said, listen, we don't know why. We've done this experiment, and we've found that there's a significant effect here, but we have no idea why it happens, which is a great project for some research scientists out there to go and slice up someone's brain and put a little electrode to see exactly why one would be faster than the other.
As usual with good science, we found something cool, we have a couple of ideas of why it might be so, and more research is required.
I love that part. Well, why don't we take a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker on CITR, and we'll be back to talk about the final frontier.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
That's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
You know, it just occurred to me that we probably should have played the Star Trek promo as opposed to the Star Wars promo because of the whole Final Frontier joke and what our topic now is, space exploration.
I wasn't making a joke. I never... What is the Final Frontier? What is...
Moving on.
Anyway, so it's been in the news recently that NASA has a new direction directed by the budget from the Obama government. So this has, you know, raised a bit of controversy, and let's take a look at it, shall we? So their new orders from the government is scrapping the plan to revisit the moon. And further, NASA will be the budget that NASA is getting now is actually insufficient to build the Ares 1 rocket, which would have been the successor to the space shuttle. So we're kind of in limbo about what exactly is going to replace the space shuttle right now.
And I believe that the space shuttle is doing its final flight and has
I believe it's been either landed or just took off or something like that. I wasn't actually paying attention to it. Anyway, you know, this is not in, you know, a nail in the coffin just yet. Congress still has to approve this budget, which who knows if it's going to happen. There's lots of congressmen who have deep ties to NASA. The new plan will see $6 billion invested over 5 years to create a commercial spacecraft that would ferry astronauts into low Earth orbit, which would be a huge change in the sort of philosophy behind NASA. We're now not going to have, what would you call it, a state-sponsored organization, but private companies responsible for putting humans in space, at least Americans. Because, you know, we don't know if the European Space Agency or the Russians or the Chinese are going to have their own programs. Probably they will. But
the Russians and Indians are really gearing up on their own space programs, as well as are the Chinese.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, in one sort of way, since they've scrapped the space shuttle, I mean, they are paying for quote-unquote private. I mean, it's another country, but they're going to be using the Russian Soyuz rockets to send things up to the space station, which I think also in the budget that they've included, they've extended the life of the space station from 2015 to 2020, which again, I think I might have even mentioned on the show before, I thought was one of the most hilarious things I ever thought, is that this year they're planning to have the space station operational, up to stuff, everything that's supposed to be up there. And then they were going to bring it back down to Earth, i.e. crash it, in 2015. It's like, you got 4 years, do what you can do, and then we're bringing you down. I mean, once we have the space station up there, I cannot see any reason ever to bring it down. I mean, even if you have to rocket it up to a higher elevation so that it decays, the orbit takes a lot longer, why would you bring it down? You have, finally, we have someplace to go in space.
It probably costs a lot of money to keep it up there. People maintaining or making sure the orbit's good, making sure it's not crashing into other things. It's
like the space junk that's up there.
It's probably not free, but yeah. I believe it was Phil Plait who brought up the point that the International Space Station, as it currently is, isn't even very good for doing science.
Yeah.
Like, it almost didn't have... It was not designed with science in mind, so I don't really understand what they're doing up there.
Well, I think they got this big, expensive laboratory. I mean, they could build a new one, but it's like, well, maybe we can just sort of retrofit the old one and, you know, come out ahead in some way. I mean, the interesting thing is this does give NASA, I guess, leeway to be a bit more innovative and to come up with some new ideas.
Well, I mean, NASA is involved in a ton of other projects, and possibly in combination with the Department of Defense. Is DARPA a NASA-funded project or something like that?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Well, I mean, this has drawn a lot of criticism, not just from space proponents, but, you know, skeptics as well, and it is somewhat controversial. Former NASA Administrator Michael Griffin had this to say: it means that, essentially, the U.S. has decided that they're not going to be a significant player in human space flight for the foreseeable future. The path they're on with this budget is a path that can't work. So, I mean, those are pretty harsh words.
Yeah. Actually, you know, and the funny thing is, too, I mean, one of the things that's really hurt NASA and this mission, the changes, is not the first change in focus, right? I mean, once the Soviet Union was sort of defeated in space and you had the Apollo missions, the focus of NASA has changed almost every 5 years. They've said, okay, we're going to scrap this idea, we're going to go with a different idea and a different idea and a different idea. And I think that's one of the things that, as a, perhaps a positive thing, that statement may be true today, but 5 years from now, there may be a new administration. Well, probably not a new administration. Okay, let's say 8 years from now, there might be a new administration, and they might say, okay, we're going to go back and we're going to have a lunar space station or whatever. Because one of the things that they said that they wanted to fund down there was refueling in space. That was one of the focuses NASA was going to be. They weren't going to worry about low Earth orbit, but once you get into orbit, you know, can we start sending people from space to other parts? Which implies to me a greater possibility for deep space exploration afterwards.
Yeah, and I like what Phil Plait had to say about this. This is what he wrote. I don't want a repeat of the Apollo program, a flag and footprints mission where we go there, look around, and then come home for another 40 years. I want to go there and stay there. And I think that's pretty, I think that's a very good, accurate, you know, way of sort of summarizing the past.
That's been a dream of scientists and nerds for generations.
But I mean, if you think about it though, Apollo was a race. You know, space exploration for a long time was a competition. It was a way of saying, you know, look, our country is more technically advanced than this country. We can get to the moon. We can go here. We can go there. And I'm not really sure that that's a great way to sort of start our exploration into space.
No, I mean, now it's come to the point where we've realized that we can go to space and test a lot of really cool scientific theories. I think that's what people should be focusing on with space exploration. The idea that we can go out there and test something in a way that we cannot test it at all on the planet Earth.
Yeah. So, I mean, the science then, I think, is more important than you know, putting up more flags, more footprints type stuff. That's what I think you're saying, and I think what Phil Plait is saying as well.
Yeah, I think we'd agree with that. But that being said, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but if I was given an opportunity to be on a space flight to Mars, and even if I was, I could never come back. You know, you go there, you're going to die in like 3 years because that's the most food we can give you, but you'd be the first one on Mars. I mean, come on, that'd be kind of cool, wouldn't it?
It'd be sweet.
Well, that brings up an interesting question then. You know, what is the optimal way for us to explore space? Is it, you know, through manned space missions like, you know, the Apollos, the space shuttles, all that? Or is it, you know, unmanned, you know, using probes and
The rovers on Mars have been phenomenally successful. I mean, they've lived far past their expiration dates. And one of them, I mean, it's been mired in dust in a crater on Mars for almost a year or maybe more. And it's still not completely dead. It's actually just been turned into a stationary laboratory.
No, actually, you know, and I mean, the amount of science, even just as a weather thing, that it goes up there. And you might be happy to hear that, what is it, about September 2011, they're launching another rover up there called Curiosity, which is supposed to be a Mars space laboratory. And if anyone's ever seen the old Voyager spacecraft that landed on Mars, it kind of looks like that, not Voyager,
the other one.
Viking.
But the one that landed on Mars.
Phoenix?
Anyhow.
One of them.
Yes. Well, that kind of ruins the whole analogy, but it looks like that on wheels. It's a much more souped-up version of the rovers designed to do much deeper scientific investigation. And I think that's actually a very good thing. It depends what is the whole point of it. If it's scientific investigation, honestly, I think robots do have it hands down just because you can do more of them. But is that the only purpose to going into space, is for exploration?
Well, let me throw this question out for you guys then. NASA announces that they're sending another robot to Mars. Are you getting up at 5 a.m. to watch the shuttle launch? Are you going to like tell your friends? Is anyone going to care?
I watched the Phoenix launch when it happened.
Okay, you did. But does anyone else care? Like, is it going to make the newspapers?
As it continues on, people are going to start caring less and less unless they do something really, really cool with it. I mean, there's only so many probes you can send until you've sent as many as you're gonna.
Yeah.
But do we really want the point of a space mission to be like the launch and then for like an hour of TV coverage and then done? Like, to me, it seems like just a colossal waste of money to send people into space with more or less the sole intent of it being like a publicity stunt.
Well, certainly we don't want it to be a publicity stunt, but I mean, if nobody cares about space exploration, if nobody cares about NASA, there's going to be no pressure for the government to fund them.
Well, part of it is, I mean, I'm sort of spitballing here, but there seems to be, in North America at least, a sort of not anti-science, but not really so much caring about science, and the exploration missions that NASA sort of wants to do get swept under with that, because who cares about watching the launch when no one cares about what possible results it's going to have? But at the same time, I mean, even just last year when they were slamming a probe into the moon to check for water, that got a ton of coverage, and people were like, wow, this is cool, we're blowing up the moon, you know?
Right.
But what about the next rock they slam into the moon, and the one after that? I mean, one of the big things about the Apollo missions is that the first Apollo moon landing, huge. Everyone, I know where I was when that happened. But they had several moon landings. They just didn't do it once. They did it several times. And by the last one, it was like, yeah, we're here. Who, you know, been there, done that. And I think that's one of the big trade-offs is, for the science is very boring, or can be very boring, because you got to go through methodically.
It's meticulous. Exactly. You have to get it right, and you have to do it repeatedly.
But to fund science, unfortunately, because we tend to live in a culture that, although appreciates the benefits of scientific innovations and that, or at least technological innovations which come from science, we tend not to like the, we don't think it's classy. So you have to have the big flashy things like the, we're going to slam a meteorite into the moon and boy, you're going to see this big pretty picture, which didn't actually show up. But I mean, that people wanted to see something like that.
That's not just a problem with space exploration and NASA. That's a problem with funding all over the sciences.
Exactly.
Applied funding seems to get more, you know, research than the sort of basic
Well, not only that, it's the whole sex thing, right? Sex sells. And in space exploration for NASA, sexy is humans doing something or big explosions or seeing something that's never been seen before. And that's one of the trade-offs that they're doing. I mean, even if we may or may not think that humans going to Mars is important, that gets people excited and people are more willing to fund a mission to Mars for that. So the science is sort of secondary, but in order to pay for the science, science is primary, but in order to pay for that, you need this flash on top of it.
But what about the risk? I mean, there have been some pretty bad disasters in the history of space exploration. Challenger, Apollo 13, Columbia. You know, if we relied on robots, no humans would die. I mean, it'd be expensive. The robots are expensive, but, you know, who cares? Someone didn't die.
Sending robots into space is cheaper than sending humans into space.
Well, sure. But, I mean, you know, you don't want your robot to blow up just for the sake of it. You want to be like, okay, well, you know, that robot that we spent like $5 million building blows up. That's a kick in the pants. But still, better than someone, you know, blowing up on a spaceship. So, you know, I think that are we maybe being overly cautious then? Like, after all, sending someone to Mars is a big endeavor. Like, they have to, you know, how are we going to get the food, the water?
At the same time, I think that, you know, robots, as cool and accurate as they can be, they still are not as flexible in what they can do as humans. So sending a properly trained scientist to a completely alien world, whether it's Mars or, you know, some moon somewhere, they will be able to take a look and, using the knowledge and flexibility of, you know, their training and the cleverness of the human mind, they will see stuff that a robot who is designed to look for only one or two things in specific won't be able to. So I think there's room for both probe and manned missions.
Do you think then that as technology advances and robotics become more, more intelligent, that will become a less and less important thing? I mean,
Well, if we get to the point where we have AIs as flexible as your average human being, I don't think we're going to be worrying about space exploration anymore.
But there is, we could get to the point, though, where robots monopolize space exploration. Like, I've heard people talking about this theory of you have where a robot, a probe, that replicates itself in space. So that when
Neumann
it just,
machine.
Yeah, breaks down, it sends out its you know, little next of kin, and it keeps doing that. And so theoretically, these robots could explore our solar system for us. And while we're sitting back, you know, on Earth in our lazy chairs, sipping a beer and watching the Olympics, you know, these robots are having all the fun.
At the same time, I don't think anyone is ever going to quash that need to explore that characterizes us as a species.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's why people go to space, you know?
Yeah.
You had the same thing with the other frontier, the ocean and deep oceans, right? I mean, robotic missions can do deep ocean exploration a lot better because you have a lot less to worry about. But people still need to go down there and see the volcanic vents and to see the weird stuff. There is a primitive thing. But you were talking about the safety issue about it. And I don't know. I mean, like I say, I'd go to Mars even if it meant that I would end up maybe dying on the planet, just because it would be such a fantastic thing to have done with one's life. And I think a lot of people who go into space, they know the risks. But, I mean, there are risks getting in your car, right? I mean, you know, if we had robotic cars, there'd be a lot less traffic accidents on the planet.
Unless the programming went wrong.
Well, yeah, as long as Toyota wasn't responsible for them. But even that said, I mean, Toyota's car accidents, there have been less deaths from that fault than have been from people just being stupid when they're driving. So there are risks to it, you're right. But I don't think that's a big thing. I mean, human life isn't cheap. But then again, you know, it has values beyond its material worth.
No, I mean, like, everyone's seen those iconic spacewalk images of someone, you know, floating in space, sort of calmly tethered to the shuttle or whatever. But those actually have huge amounts of danger to them.
You may not know this, but those are always silent. And the reason why they're silent is because the guy in there is going, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God.
Actually, most of the most iconic images, just some trivia that I found on IO9, those are pictures of Edward White, the first American to spacewalk, and that those were taken in 1965 on the Gemini 4 mission.
Hmm.
But actually, like, some of the dangers that you do when you're spacewalking, it looks really calm and sort of floaty, but you have to remember that they're in orbit. They are hurtling at 17,000 miles per hour, and if they get hit by even a bit of space debris, they're going to die. You know, not to mention their spacesuits don't have a lot of radiation shielding, and there is a ton of radiation out there. You can get the bends, you know. It's dangerous.
You know what I'd really like to talk about next is colonization of space.
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break, and then we'll talk about colonization of space. How about that?
He's going into shock. We're losing him. Give me the paddles. We're going to have to shock him. Clear. Again. Clear. Again. Oh, man.
Local independent print media is in danger of expiring. The Discorder needs your help. Friday, March 5th, CITR hosts a night at the Biltmore to raise funds for Discorder magazine. An all-star lineup of local acts have donated their time to the cause. Performers include Apollo Ghosts, Fine Mist, MT40, Coban, Fanshawe, and Boogie Monster, as well as a special DJ set by the Japan Droids and CITR DJs Cam Dales and Tyler Fedchuk. Amidst the entertainment will be prize giveaways and a silent auction with wicked swag. Keep local independent print media alive and kicking. Friday, March 5th at the Biltmore Cabaret, 395 Kingsway in Vancouver.
So we're back, and as we said, we're going to talk about colonization. We've been talking a lot about the exploration of space, but really, I think one of the things that's really important is the idea of colonization. We were talking in our last episode about population overpopulation Earth, and Rob said, kind of disparagingly, but I think he had it bang on, is that one of the best ways to solve population issues is colonization. Above that, you also have the whole idea that at some point in the future, all life on this planet will be extinguished, be it in 3 billion years when the sun goes boom, a meteorite hitting us tomorrow at 3 o'clock, just so everyone knows. Not that 2012 is real, but there's a lot of crap out there that we don't know about that'll hit us. Eventually, life will, and if humans want to exist, at least existentially in the future, space colonization is one of the best ways. Why do we need to go to Mars? It's fun, sure, but if we're on Mars and Earth gets destroyed, we have a backup. There's a plan B for human race.
And then it could spread through the entire galaxy like a virus, destroying everything that we come across.
Yay.
what a wonderful image. I think, though, I mean, that's a very sort of hopeful image of our future, but I mean, it's going to take a lot of stepping stones to get to that stage where we can actually say, okay, let's transplant 1,000 people to another planet. Obviously, our technology is going to have to advance tremendously. I think that we're going to have to look into things like terraforming, I mean, which has only existed in science fiction up till now.
Well, unless you believe in global warming, but...
Okay.
Sorry, I just had to make that plug.
Okay. But, okay, so we decide, okay, we're going to colonize Mars, we're going to transplant, you know, 1,000 people there. You know, just how, pardon the expression, how on earth are we going to do that?
Well, you know, if you took a small portion of the American military budget, for example, I mean, if you took the money that they spent in Iraq, right,
mm-hmm.
and you transferred that over to NASA, you could do it then. Or, as they always say, I mean...
Okay, well, I have to... the amount of money they spend in Iraq is, yes, a huge waste and a lot of money. But that doesn't mean we can send people out to the far reaches of space with it.
Oh, come on. If we send Al-Qaeda out there, how could they possibly attack
it's inside? Roughly the same as like, you know, the amount of money that people spent eating ice cream in America last year. If you rerouted that to Africa, you could solve world hunger. It's useful as a comparison of the size of the amount of money that would be necessary to do something, but it's probably not going to happen just because of the decisions and the way people make them.
Not only that, but I don't think you can do that in any, like, small time frame with that much money.
Well, no, but I guess the point being is that there isn't actually an absence of resources. The resources are there. We have just chosen not to use those resources in this particular cause.
No, it's the sort of thing where space colonization remains in the realm of science fiction, not because we can't really start doing work on it, but because we focus on, I guess, more earthbound problems, but also because there's just this, you know, we don't like spending money on pie-in-the-sky type stuff.
Quite literally. But, I mean, there's also, like, other problems as well. I mean, you know, suppose that the United States decides we're going to put a colony on the moon. How does that work legally? Like, you know, if you...
Would it be have like, to be an international colony?
Well, yeah. Like, I mean, what would happen if, like, Britain decided, okay, we're going to colonize Antarctica? Like, I mean, aren't there legal implications of this sort of thing?
I remember when I was much younger, I saw some advertisement somewhere for buying, like, a parcel of land on the moon. And their justification was that there's some UN resolution or something that says that no country is allowed to own parts of the moon. So they went and said, well, then we can sell the parts of the moon. I almost wanted to buy one.
you're making a joke about that, but Russia, the Soviet Union, when it was, landed some rovers on the moon, and they had the first remotely controlled rovers in space exploration. But they were recently sold. Well, 1993, they were sold to the developer of Ultima, whose name I can't quite remember. But he bought that. He bought them, and he has said, jokingly, that he actually has the strongest claim on there, because the UN resolution says no country can own it. He isn't a country, and he actually has property on Mars, on the moon. Therefore, he claims the moon as his own property, because it's, yeah. So, but we're getting away from...
Speaking of selling things off, NASA is getting rid of, boosters and old shuttles. So if anyone has a lot of space and a lot of money...
but I think we're getting...
Very good souvenir.
You're bringing up a very good thing. So there are legal issues, there are technical issues, but if by ignoring them doesn't solve them. And like I say, they're like with the idea of population. I mean, you can ignore the issue for only so long before something's going to come and smack you in the face. Well, the dinosaurs don't exist because they didn't have space colonies.
Well, according to Star Trek Voyager, they did. But moving on. So Don, maybe you're on the right track there. I mean, obviously we got to start somewhere. One idea that's been floating around for a long time is building a colony on the moon. Maybe not like a colony, but, you know, a permanent settlement.
A base, a moon base.
Yeah, exactly.
We could call it moon base alpha.
No. Why would building a moon base be better than, say, you know, going to Mars or building more on the space station? Well, I would suggest that it's practice for humans living in space. Getting the hang of it, figuring out, like, you know, we don't know what we're going to need, what we're going to have to face until we actually try it.
Not only that, but it we could actually have a proper space laboratory on the moon, and, you know, it's actually easier to get to the moon than
Mars. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, it's easier to get to and from other places from the moon than from the planet Earth. Because of the way it rotates and the way you have to, like, you know, account for a lot of gravity and for the effects of atmosphere.
I'm guessing there's a bit of a slingshot effect to it as well, because the moon rotates around, and wouldn't that, like, help launch people farther without using as much energy?
It's also got less gravity, so it's easier to escape.
Yeah, so there's, you know, benefits to building a base on the moon that are numerous.
Right. Right.
Not to mention that, you know, if you want to see little green men, it's probably easier to see them from the moon than...
Well, you know, you're actually bringing up another point, too. I mean, if we don't put a lunar colony there, if we don't colonize Mars...
Someone else will.
Space aliens are going to get... And we know they're out there. Right?
Well, being a bit facetious here, but there is a wealth of places to look for life outside of... planet Earth. One of the major, major questions of, you know, science is how did life originate? And we've so far only been able to look at it from one perspective, our own. And it would be so cool to see if it has arisen elsewhere. And so one of the major reasons, I think, and you know, famous skeptic Carl Sagan would agree, space exploration is about partially finding out about the origins of life and seeing if other life exists.
Well, Don, you were mentioning that we know, or at least we're pretty darn sure, that some planets out there have oceans on them, and we think that water is one of the primary, you know, requirements for life.
Actually, yeah. When I was doing research for the show, there are actually four major places for life outside of Earth and out there. There's Titan, which has its own atmosphere and methane lakes, which is it. Europa, which most people are acquainted with, and they believe it has a subsurface ocean, planetary ocean. Callisto, which is a Jupiter's moon, which they think has a subsurface, like it's like a thin layer of water that goes all around, and it's salty water, which means it's good for conducting, so it's a good electrolyte for life. And Enceladus, which just recently the Cassini space probe has done some research and says it probably has a subsurface ocean as well.
Well, last I checked, though, we have telescopes, we have the Kepler array and the Hubble thing, and we got our robots. Do we have to go there? Anyone?
Yes, we do.
Okay, that's satisfying.
You know, actually, that's another thing. You know, if we only
it's sort of like, you know, why would we climb Mount Everest? And people say because it's there. I mean, the answer I think is analogous. Like, we can just send probes up to the top of Mount Everest. We can look at the top of Mount Everest with a telescope. But going there yourself is a whole different level of exploration. And going to other planets ourselves, going and, you know, finding other life ourselves, going and testing, you know, the basic tenets of physics and how planets and stars are formed in person would go that much further to furthering our knowledge.
You know, and going back to your risk, I mean, Everest was a great thing. I mean, people still go up to Everest in K2, and a lot of people die every year from height toxicity, whatever it is, because you lack of oxygen and pressure. So, I mean, yeah, there is an instinctive thing in there. But I don't think we should be all manned exploration. I think you got a great point. You know, the
balance.
The Hubble Space Telescope is living on borrowed time as it is. And the next telescope to go up, I think, is 2015 or something. They've got another one. But, I mean, one thing that drives me nuts is how come they just don't take a rocket, put a camera on the end of it, and send it to Alpha Centauri? I mean, okay, so it's going to take it 50 years to get there. But it will get there eventually.
If it goes at the speed of light.
No, well, actually...
How far away is Alpha Centauri?
I think it's only four... let's say...
Four-ish light years?
Yeah, I think it's only four.
I don't know.
Okay, well, that's still pretty far.
But the point is, you send it out there, and then you'd get the... You could see what was there. But anyhow, I digress. But if we do this exploration, find out how many times life has evolved in our thing, I mean, mathematically, and I believe there's an equation out there that helps show this, we can know how much life could exist in the universe.
No, there's a Fermi, the famous physicist, was at lunch with a bunch of other scientists one day, and he asked, you know, out of the blue, where is everybody? And everyone sort of looked at him like, what do you mean? We're all right here. And he explained that, no, if there is even a small chance that life evolves in some planet, and the universe truly is infinite, then there should be an infinite number of life forms out there. Where is everybody?
Why don't we examine that question when we get back from this commercial break?
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite! Want to know how to choose the right courses for your program? Want to learn more about majors, minors, honors, and professional programs? Are you looking for information about co-op, exchange, or careers? This is how we do it. The Imagine Your Arts Major Fair is a one-stop shop where professors, advisors, student leaders, and staff from over 60 programs within arts are brought together in one place so that you, the student, may connect with different departments. Imagine Your Arts Major, March 17th at the Student Union Building Ballroom from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. In addition, there will be workshops between March 8th and 12th offered by Arts Advising, Arts Co-op, Career Services, and Go Global. For more information, visit our website at www.arts.ubc.ca/students/IYAM. Imagine Your Arts Major, March 17th at the Student Union Building Ballroom from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker on CITR. And we're talking about space exploration, and we're talking about alien life in space. And Rob hinted that there might be an equation out there that helps us understand if there are intelligent civilizations out there. And there is. It's called the Drake Equation.
Yeah, the astronomer, I believe Frank Drake is his name.
Who's still alive, actually, and I think I heard him in an interview.
Yeah, he did a story recently about this very topic. He was reported on in the UK, I believe, in The Guardian and all over the place. But basically, he came up with the idea that it's a probability. There's a probability that life exists and evolved somewhere other than the planet Earth. And to figure out what this probability is, all you really have to do is come up with a bunch of smaller probabilities and multiply them together. And Ethan has the equation written
yes.
down and can tell us all the terms.
Very, very impressive. So the equation is N equals R times FP times NE times FE times FI times FC times L.
I hope you were listening. There'll be a quiz.
That's right. So let's explain this a bit more in depth. N equals the number of civilizations in our galaxy with which communication might be possible. R is the average rate of star formation per year in our galaxy. FP is the fraction of those stars that have planets. NE is the average number of planets that can potentially support life. FE is the fraction of the above that actually go on to develop life at some point. FI is the fraction of the above that actually go on to develop intelligent life. FC, the fraction of civilizations that develop a technology that releases detectable signs of their existence into space. And L, the length of time such civilizations who release detectable signals into space exist for.
So, and actually, a lot of those we're beginning to come to terms with, because with our great telescopes and our great things, we're beginning to find out how many stars out there have planets, how many of those planets are Earth-like. I mean, we're not quite at the point where we can see Earth-like planets, but those are actually knowable factors. We might even get to the point where we can say, what are the probability of a planet developing life as we know it, with more exploration of our own solar system, once we have more than one data point, as they keep pointing out.
Well, I mean, some of these points, though, are still quite controversial. I'll explain some of the current estimates. So, for average star rate formation, it's estimated 7 per year. The fraction of those stars that have planets, the current estimate is between 20% and 40%, and that's mostly from the Kepler array that is proving to be it's really a fountain of information. So that's pretty awesome. The average number of planets that can potentially support life, that's a pretty big estimate. I mean, we can't really be certain. The best one, I think, is greater than 0.0.05. So, I don't mean that's coming basically from sort of Kepler. I mean, it's found 5. Of all the ones that it's found, it's found 5 that maybe can support life. The fraction of those planets that go into develop life, well, current estimate is greater than 0.13.
And we should point out that one is probably one of the biggest ifs.
Yeah, that's the one that has, I think, a lot of controversy around it. I mean, these ones too, but well, the fraction that go on to develop intelligent life. The general consensus is that there is no general consensus. Drake used 0.01, probably is fair, I suppose.
Well, yeah, the, like the way that this equation works is that you start off with like really, really general because you're going from a very large number and you keep adding a fraction of that. You're taking fractions and then a fraction of that and then a fraction of that. So as you go down, you're becoming more and more specific. And because we haven't done a lot of space exploration, when you get to the really specific ones, like how many planets are there that can support intelligent life, you're sort of guessing.
You're kind of using ourselves as a basis. You're going, okay, well, we have 9 planets, one of them supports life type thing, and you're kind of making broad generalizations. And the same sort of thing for the next point, the fraction of civilizations that develop technology and release detectable signs of their existence. You know, Drake estimated 0.01. The interesting one, I think, is the length of time the civilizations exist for. Drake said 10,000 years. Michael Shermer suggested 420 years.
So even if you take really conservative estimates for pretty much all of these terms, you still get quite a large number of intelligent life that can communicate.
If you crunch these numbers, you get 2.31 civilizations in our galaxy with which communication might be possible.
And then, of course, that's just the first step. If those civilizations do exist, and let's say they do, let's say there's 10 times that many, galaxy's a huge friggin' place.
Yeah.
And as far as we know, we're still limited to light communication. It's the fastest we have. And our own communications heading out are only, I think, about 50 light years, because we've only been
doing this for about,
Well, the Nazis were the first ones. They have to be first at something that's good, and their communication.
Yeah, contact. I was going to say that contact talks about this idea very well. It actually, the beginning of the movie starts with us pulling out the camera, sort of zooming away from the planet Earth. Well, and as it's going out, you hear these broadcasts of historic broadcasts from Earth.
So the question
going
is
back
then,
in time,
if advanced life exists, why hasn't it found us?
Well, see, and there, of course, we have human centrism, right? Sort of form of speciesism. Why would they even care? I mean, there are lots of species on this planet that we don't really know about.
Who knows? It could be roughly the same as, why haven't they found us in the same way? Well, why don't we pay that much attention to the bacteria that live in our intestines?
But the bacteria haven't cracked the atom.
That's a great example. How would they know if we've cracked the atom?
That's kind of the point I'm trying to make, though. Like, if the whole repeating robots thing, a lot of people, especially proponents of the whole singularity thing, think that would be a natural extension of any advanced technological civilization. Why haven't they done it yet? If they exist, why hasn't? I mean, you'd think that if you had an advanced civilization, they would think of a way to explore space, either to conquer or destroy or whatever. And if they haven't found us, either distance is just too great, which is a possibility, or they're not out there.
I mean, the thing that often gets lost in these kinds of speculations is that who's to say that if there is an intelligent life form out there, that they'll have in any way any kind of values that are related to the ones that we have?
I mean,
why would they value exploration? Why would they value conquering? Why would they value communication even?
Well, I mean, but if you think about it, though, we have to assume, though, for the sake of just, our own logic, that they evolved and sort of Darwinian natural selection that would favor a species that, wants to explore, that, is curious about this environment, that sort of thing.
I'm gonna slam you on that. Let's use Earth as an example. How many species on this planet are conquering species? How many forms of life on this planet are human-like? And maybe 5 if you extend it to the great apes and maybe whales.
On that point, though, that might be to non-intelligent life, it might be a useless thing. But we don't know. Exploration might be an absolutely important part of intelligent life. Expanding outwards.
But see, that's the thing, though. We're
this
just
is,
guessing.
This is why that term.
For all
at the
we
end
know,
the
like they may not value exploration, but for all we know, they may overvalue exploration. Like, I mean, we're just totally guessing a shot in the dark here. We have absolutely no basis to make any assumptions about this sort of thing.
Which is why we need more space exploration.
Well, that's a good point. So I encourage our listeners to email us and let us know what they think about this whole, you know, quantity of space exploration, the Drake equation, man versus unmanned space exploration. You know, email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts, and we encourage you to contact us. Well, we're running out of time, so why don't we go on to our skeptical highlights?
I'll start off here, just considering the thing. It's not really a highlight so much, but I'm going to do a plug for SETI. As many of you know, that there's been an ongoing attempt to listen to the stars and to find out their space out there, and I would recommend anyone going to the SETI.org and check out their website, and they've got a little applet that runs on your computer where you help listen to the things to find out, is there a message in the background radiation of the universe? Is someone trying to send a message to us?
I'm not sure if it was the first, but it's definitely one of the first distributed computing platforms that basically, like, they created this little app that lets you network via the internet a ton of users' computers, and it runs as sort of a screensaver.
And just think of how cool it would be when your computer starts flashing red and starts smoking when it says, hey, I found something.
I've actually seen a fake, like, joke screensaver that you can install on someone's computer that's running SETI at home that looks exactly like it, and it starts blinking and, like, reports, you know, alien life found.
That'd be nice. Well, I have an event to promote, and that is Skeptics in the Pub. Turns out we're having a second Skeptics in the Pub a month.
We have had, you know, so much interest, so much people are interested in and are actually coming out to Skeptics in the Pub meetings that we need a second one.
That's right. So it's happening tomorrow, March 3rd, and it's taking place at the Billy Bishop Legion in Kitsilano from 7:30 to 10:30. The address is 1407 La Burnham Street. Don't fret. If you love the Railway Club, though, we're still going to have the regular Skeptics in the Pub at the Railway Club, which will be happening later this month. So, you know, go to both and meet lots of different skeptics, drink, have a great time, order some pizza. You'll have a fantastic time at the Billy Bishop. It's very nice, very comfortable.
And it's in my neighborhood, so if you want to meet one of the hosts of Radio Freethinker, I'll be there.
Yeah, that'll bring the crowds in.
I have a little thing. Next Monday on March 8th at 7:30 here at UBC, Quirks and Quarks is coming to UBC to do their annual question show. So if you've always wanted to see Bob McDonald on stage and want to ask some questions,
you can ask him about the red thing.
Yeah.
Do you know where it is?
I didn't have that info.
Isn't it at the Chan Center?
I think it might be.
Yeah. So I guess our listeners can, we'll post it in the show notes, check it out, and we'll give you some links to getting information.
EA/Quirks.
Excellent. Well, there is another event that we should promote, and that is the CFI conference in Toronto. And myself and Daniel are going to go to this conference, and we'll be doing some interviews and providing coverage. And so I encourage you to tune into our next show, where we'll provide all the details on this conference. Isn't that right, Daniel?
Yes, unless we get lots, where maybe we'll spread it out over a few. But
yeah,
listen next week.
So, yeah. So you guys are going there with your tape recorders and whatnot, and
oh yeah, well hopefully, you know, we get down to, you know, doing some recordings, but you know we might be too busy partying up in Toronto because we are two wild and crazy guys, right, Daniel?
I don't know if I want to answer that.
We should make a point here that Daniel and Ethan are not associated in any way. And just an update, I just did a check. Quirks and Quarks is March 8th at 7:30. It's at the Chan Center, and they recommend getting tickets. You can get tickets at the Chan Center. They're free anytime, Monday to Saturday, from 12 to 5. It might get filled up, so it might be good if you rush down there right now after our show and pick up some tickets.
That's right. And, of course, if you're not going to do that, I encourage you to visit our webpage at radiofreethinker.com and read our blogs and download our podcast and become our fan on Facebook and make your friends become our fan, too. Because it's nice. Well, anything else we have to remind our listeners?
That's about it for me.
All right, then. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good evening.
This is Daniel saying thanks for listening.
Big
government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education, every Tuesdays at 4 p.m.